Well, I had an idea of what to speak about this time. We just had our winter retreat in January through March. And then just emerging from that retreat, I had a chance to offer a four-day at-home meditation retreat on the theme of dependent origination. It's been so fruitful this time around to have that opportunity. And then my friend Aya Nyanika is here from the Aloka Vihara, just on a short visit, and she asked what I would speak about, and I thought, well, why don't I just see whether in about 30 minutes I could give a summary of dependent origination that will make you understand the essence of it. Only because I spent, how many days really thinking and pondering and studying and collecting things, and then 4 days talking about it, and then another 4 days editing the tapes and perfecting the bibliography, et cetera, et cetera. And now having all done all that, I'll just forget about the details and think, we'll say, what's the point? What's the essence? The Buddha, our teacher, woke up by the realization of dependent origination. He very often said, if you see dependent origination, you see my Dhamma. If you see my Dhamma, you will see dependent origination. There's a 12-part formula, which we recite every day here in the temple. It's almost impossible to understand. And probably that 12-part formula was could have been expanded or locked into the most famous format that we remember it in by the subsequent generations. You know that the Buddhist teachers in the olden days used lists quite a bit to sustain the integrity of the teachings that they were trying to remember. But in the essence, the arising of dependent origination is about dukkha, why we suffer, and how suffering works, how suffering arises. This was the Buddha's quest as a young man when he saw old age, sickness, and death. Being so conscientious, compassionate, sensitive, and determined, he just felt there had to be an answer. How can we understand how people suffer so much? And is there a way out? Is there a way out from suffering? So just the same way, even though it makes people think that Buddhism is too pessimistic, dukkha, after all, is the first noble truth. And a lot of people come to the Dhamma and they have the first urgency to develop their practice because of the difficulties that they're sustaining. It could be because they have some hard circumstances, psychological difficulties, social difficulties, problems in life, or they have encounters with old age, sickness, and death, and loss and sorrow, which are traumatic. And then in that state of desperation and trauma, they have the spiritual urgency and are seeking and striving. So if for that reason, it is certainly good to investigate what dukkha is and how it works. A way that I heard from Stephen Batchelor, which I like very much. His idea is that if a person really understands the extent of the problem with dukkha, the mind would naturally let go of craving. Why would you crave for what's dukkha? You wouldn't crave it. And if somebody were to experience even a moment of having really let go of craving, or some particular part of their craving they had before, they craved after something, and in a moment of realization, they just drop it, just put it down. They don't crave it. Then exactly in that moment, they can experience the cessation of the dukkha that was connected to that particular craving. And they can get the idea there is a way out. It's not necessary to always be trapped in a trap and stuck in an abyss. There is a way out of it. And then if you have that experience a little bit, then you may gain a lot of interest and enthusiasm to see how far we can go with this and how well we can understand peeling the onion and getting layer after layer of the things that we suffer over, the things that we are actually still attached to, the things that we actually are still craving after, and can we layer by layer by layer let go of them to come towards the unconditioned, the state that's really free, that's really out of that prison. And that would be the fourth noble truth, which is the path leading to the end of craving, to the end of dukkha. I think that the aspect of dukkha or suffering that the Buddha saw, I'm going to put it under 4 points. And so if you want to practice the way I did, I know everybody doesn't have come to the Dhamma by the same path. So you don't have to follow this path. But if you need to understand dukkha, here's four kinds of dukkha. One is the kind of dukkha that we get because we got born as a human animal with this body, which is made of living flesh, which is subjected to old age, sickness, and death. So it's all of the pain and suffering and the burden of having a physical body, having the necessity of taking care of that body, making so many efforts to keep the life going and to get our life into some kind of a state of comfort and safety, and all of the efforts that we make are continuously falling apart. So we feel in the end, no matter how hard we try, just because of impermanence, we cannot succeed in keeping the body together in a state of perfect health and eternal life. So we feel disappointed to be the kind of animal that has a flesh and blood body. And we feel disappointed with the things around us, which are always changing. So that's one part of dukkha. Another part of dukkha is the existence of so much evil and cruelty in the world. You see, in the time of the Buddha, wars, cruel punishments, people who were callous and careless, people who didn't care, people who would steal, people who would be not sympathetic and not kind, horrible tortures that rulers would inflict on people, terrible things that bandits would do to people. And today, we're almost in exactly the same boat, or maybe our boat has gotten worse than it was before, because we have many more weapons of war. We're capable of inflicting pain on a much larger scale than we were before. We're capable of accumulating inequality of wealth so that greed is much greater than it was before, and the existence of beings that are forced to live in a state that's either slavery or kind of like being a wage slave or something that's just having to struggle to survive because of the greed of cruel people who just don't care. We can see even in modern times that it seems like, you know, for a while, according to the statistics, we heard that the death from warfare was declining in the period from the end of World War II up until recent times. Sociologists said that actually, even though there were a lot of smaller wars, the amount of death in the whole world because of warfare and genocide was actually less than it had been at earlier times in history. And so it seemed like the world was becoming more kindly. But then now we look around and say, oh, that was just a brief moment, and the world is not getting more kind after all. And the cruelty seems to be accelerating. And so it is dukkha. It's even more painful to be aware of the suffering and hardship that is inflicted because of cruelty than the suffering that's just inflicted by nature. So, when I was young, I fell off my bike and had a concussion or something like that, and I was in the hospital and, I hurt or something like that. But I don't look back remembering falling off the bike and like weeping because I fell off a bike when I was a kid. But if my father was mean to me and teased me or at the dinner table or something like that, I could still, I'm not actually burning with pain about it, but a person could still be like burning with pain and in tears and still traumatized because of some cruelty that they had suffered. So I feel that this human evil and cruelty is even more traumatic than the pain that comes from nature. So that's the second kind of dukkha. And then the third kind of dukkha is weariness that we feel with going on the round of rebirth again and again, having to go through birth, old age, sickness, and death, and then coming around to another birth, old age, sickness, and death, not knowing how to get off the merry-go-round, or even just seeing a sort of like the futility of this life. There's a trope about how a small child would like to be old enough to go to school. And when they're in elementary school, they would like to be old enough to go to high school, and then they would like to go to college, or they would like to get a job, they would like to get a wife, they would like to get a house, and sort of like continuously being led along by wanting to accomplish the next stage of life, which is a little bit, it's sort of like a metaphor for being reborn again and again, because the child, can be like reborn as a junior high school student or something like that. And then the culmination of this joke is that after they have accumulated enough wealth to take care of their family and their children and kept their job and managed to save enough money for the, to have a comfortable retirement, then if they're really lucky, they can get into a good nursing home and get a good hospice care at the end of their life. So going from state to state, but if that was the sum of our aspiration, we can see how futile it is. And so there's this suffering of the realm, this weariness with rebirth again and again. And then sort of on the other side of that is what's called, what I call existential anxiety, where naturally the way we are wired together, most people have the idea that they exist, they're alive, and they exist. I am somebody. And then when we face up to the reality of death and separation, this brings up the most profoundest fear of all, the fear of having the self to be erased. And even if one has studied the Dhamma or had some insights about the way that the self is something that's just sort of like a fabrication of the mind, nevertheless, if somebody is choking you and you can't breathe, you know, you want to be able to breathe. You want to be able to exist. And it's to soothe this existential anxiety that there come about the two kinds of craving that the Buddha teaches about, called bhava tanha, the craving for existence, and vibhava tanha, which is translated as craving for non-existence. Just this recently, while I was studying about dependent origination, I came across a wonderful alternative way of thinking about vibhava tanha. This is coming from Nagarjuna as it's explained by Jay Garfield. So the idea is the craving for existence, the bhava tanha, is typically expressed in terms of wanting a heavenly existence. So one could go to an eternal, pleasant realm and enjoy a lot of pleasures in heaven. So you go where everything that you see is pleasant and beautiful, what you touch, hear and smell are all so beautiful and pleasant, and even your thoughts are so beautiful and pleasant while you're in heaven. And so the idea of having a heavenly rebirth, that's the bhava tanha. And then this is an interpretation of Nagarjuna, that the vibhava tanha is imagining that there could be a state that doesn't have any more becoming. So we know that always, like as we go through this life, we're always in a flow of conditions, and because of this flow of karma and the flow of conditions, we're always becoming something. So the little kid is becoming the student, and the student is becoming the high school student, becoming the college student, and just always becoming something else. And so they want to stop the merry-go-round and get off but they imagine that there is a state of existence where there is a self which goes into this kind of suspended animation, that there is no more becoming. So a self in an existence which has no more becoming, no more round of samsara, no more birth. And, you know, the Buddha definitely looked into this. And he, if he had been able to validate that this was possible, maybe he would have taught it. But it's not possible because there's no self. It's not, there is not any such state that has an existence with no flux or flow in it that still has a self. And if somebody strives for that, all they do is they get themselves into a maybe a very quiet, extremely peaceful, immaterial realm where they can stay for 84,000 eons and then fall back into a different realm. So the four ways we suffer: old age, evil, and cruelty, and the weariness with the round, and existential anxiety. So how it works psychologically, I can reduce the 12 points of dependent origination to two. One is the group of feeling. So everything about like how we like, what we like and dislike, all of the reactions that are triggered by feeling, the craving that's triggered by feeling, everything that gets activated in us that's making us do things and pick up things because we want to get more life, or that we want to get what supports life. So it's all in the realm of feeling, and it's all centered around the vedana, the feeling. So the sensation is happening because something is coming through one of the gates and the corresponding consciousness arises. So we have an experience with some kind of a sense impression, and it's either pleasant or unpleasant. And just right there, we like it or we don't like it. And if we don't have wisdom, we can slip down the slide, which is leading us on the cycle of rebirth. But if we do have wisdom, it's possible to stop it there. And a feeling is just a feeling. It doesn't have to lead to anything else. So that's one part. That's kind of like the middle section of the 12 steps of dependent origination. And then the other part is about ideas and concepts. So most people, if you ask them, they kind of feel like, well, feelings and emotions, we know that they're very transient and changeable and very like unreliable. And if you had a person who just follows their emotions as their guideline for life, you said they're probably going to be an immature person, or it's not going to really work out if that's all you follow, because emotions are unreliable. Or even some people think that emotions are like lower or something like that. But then people think that their rational mind is higher, more idealistic, more like dealing with concepts which are maybe like not changing, they think. But actually, you can see that if you look closely, you really study it as the Buddha studied it, that the mind fabricates all of the ideas and concepts. And it very often fabricates the ideas and concepts driven by the feeling. So actually the feeling is more powerful than the thoughts. The thoughts are just kind of like coming up behind, making up a lot of excuses for why we feel this way. But then what happens, and it's not only our own, like our individual thoughts, we think that the thoughts are just belong to us, but a lot of them are inherited from our culture, from our community, from our family, from our group, and from our nation. And so we have all of these thoughts and concepts, some of which are maybe unique to us, and some of them are ones that we inherit or we share, or we picked them up here and there, like picking up a virus. We picked up a lot of thoughts and concepts, and we choose the ones that we want to believe in and cling to the concepts that we choose to cling to. And with that, we fabricate a world. And the world that we have fabricated through our concepts becomes the prison in which we are obliged to live. So that's the second part of the arising of dukkha. Through many a birth, I wandered in samsara, seeking but not finding the builder of this house. Sorrowful it is to be born again and again. O house builder, thou art seen. Thou shalt build no house again. All thy rafters are broken, thy ridge is shattered. My mind has attained the unconditioned. Achieved is the end of craving. So what this is saying is, when you can see through the tendency of your own mind to be continuously fabricating and fabricating, to be continuously reacting, favoring and opposing according to the feeling, when you just see through it, actually that seeing, that discernment, that insight is the thing that breaks up the show. And I'll give another poem that's related to the Buddha's awakening and how it relates to dependent arising. When things become clear to a keen meditating Brahmin, his doubts are dispelled, since he understands each thing and its cause. When things become clear to a keen meditating Brahmin, his doubts are dispelled, since he's known the end of conditions. While we are still in the trap and the mind is still into all of this fabrication, it's a little bit theoretical what this end of conditions would be. How one could be in a state of not picking up any identification at all, not favoring anything, not opposing anything, not constructing anything, not fabricating anything. But nevertheless, as we go along, and I know that all of you in the room are very mature meditators who have been doing this for a bunch of years, and you will be able to look back on your life and see how, yeah, I used to be overly involved. I used to fall into a lot of traps, and I'm not really falling into them so much anymore. And what the Buddha suggests is, don't worry, just keep practicing. Keep practicing with faith. Be with people who have got what you who've realized something that you would like to realize. And with time, it will come to you. You'll be that very last moment when you got a glimpse of what it is to be really free. You know, like you can see it, but you know you don't have it consistently because you keep like falling back into emotions or something like that, or keep falling back into opinions. But you could see it. And then you'll be, you know, like practicing. And it's like, oh, I want to be free. Oh, I want this perfect peace. But as long as you want it, you can't have it. So then, you know, there's going to be something in your practice when you just forget about wanting anything and you just practice, and then big pieces of this clinging and craving and a concoction of fabrications of delusions just falls away. So these are my Dhamma reflections, and I think I've left a few minutes for your comments or questions.
Thank you so much. Dependent origination is one of my favorite Buddhist topics. So when you said you were going to talk about it, I was so excited. My name is Isabel. I'm a longtime member of this group.
Oh, very good. Now you've let us see your face. Isabel, if you would like to hear my retreat, if you go to the YouTube channel of the Dhammadharini Monastery, you could find the retreat is named the Transformation Retreat. And okay. It's about dependent origination.
Yeah. I've heard some of your other talks on Dharma Seed, yeah. But I'll look for YouTube is even better. Yeah. And so my question is, and maybe it's not answerable, but I'm just, as you were talking, you know, I probably fall a little bit in the category where I do a little bit less clinging than I used to over the years, but like, what would it look like? Can you say, like, give a short example of what it might look like if I was like one person who would be maybe getting on the dependent origination train and not knowing and being unaware, and then maybe like the same, what would it be like that if they didn't? Like what, you know, how would they, would it just be more letting go, or maybe just if that's possible? I know it's a big ask, so don't worry if you can't do it.
Right. The metaphor that came along, we were talking about this earlier, and a metaphor came along about like office politics. If you imagine that a fully enlightened being were a college professor, they would become incapable of getting involved in academic politics. It's just whatever little turf wars or whatever it is that academics do among themselves. This Arahant professor would just be like not taking one side, not taking the other side. They would just never be able to take a side because it doesn't, none of it matters. And so they would be like, you know, sort of like just floating on a different planet. So then here's these other academics that are like asuras that are always, you know, in a battle. And then this other enlightened teacher would be floating above.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thank you for everything you do. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So what happens with real politics? like getting in the like engaged Buddhism?
Yes. Whenever we get involved, the positions that we take are always coming from some motives. And so if we're taking a side, based on some gain or benefit for us, like some greed that we want to get something from taking a particular side, or then there's something that we hate and we want to get rid of what we hate by taking a particular side. So to the extent that greed and hatred are in our motivation, then it's really not going to be supporting to our practice to be engaged in that way. And then behind that greed and hatred, then also becomes a lot of delusions about, you know, like I am somebody, or, you know, I need to be respected, or all these like selfish delusions come in behind it, and it all becomes into a kind of a toxic mess. So if you are able to really clear up your motivations, and so that then, like in a certain way, even though you're in the same meeting, in a certain way, you're kind of like standing aside from what a lot of other people are into, because most people are into, when they're involved with this kind of power struggle, it's because of their, what they want to gain or what they fear. One can, in a certain way, you know, strategically be silent, and then also strategically speak the truth. But because of being like disengaged at the level of getting involved with greed and fear or greed and hatred, it can happen that that your truth will be able to be heard. I've met people like this. You know, there can be like a big, you know, whatever it is, a conference or a convention or a summit or something like that, and a lot of people are getting agitated, and then there's like a, you know, one person who's just like kind of like quiet and like taking it all in. And then if they get their moment and they speak, you know, like kind of like with sincerity or from the heart in a way that's very authentic, that they can be heard and they can help to move the room away from this kind of like a toxic pit that groups can sometimes get into, and help others to remember their more pure motivations, their pure intentions, their intentions of, you know, compassion, kindness, and so forth like that. So that's my suggestion.
Thank you.
Things that touch on our survival are very triggering. So a lot having to do with the pandemic is very triggering for a lot of people. Things having to do with climate change are very triggering to people, because not only our own individual life, but also a person could feel a lot of grief for the beings in the world. It's like we were born in this lovely garden that was so with so many wonderful things, and now we've trashed it so badly that it possibly, you know, would not come back, and it's going to be a very different and difficult, you know, desert of woe. And so, but having gone through like a grieving or resentment or depression or all of the other emotions that we can have about climate change, then we may, in the end, come back and realize, well, that we're alive. Why don't we try to practice not killing and being tender and considerate towards all forms of life, and to do this openly and to share with our friends and colleagues, say, well, why don't we just try to protect life and do whatever we can that protects life? Why don't we try honesty to try to discover the truth and say things that are true? And regardless of whether the world is a wonderful wonderland or whether the world is a desert of woe, we're still alive and we're humans and we still can make these. And this is, in the Buddha's teaching, really what's available to us, even when the world has descended into a really horrible place. I know the moment will come at some point that you want to take the dedication of merits and so forth. Is there time for one? Is there one more question?
I had a question about if all of this leads to neutrality, right? You're not really on one side of the fence or the other, then where do we get the motivation to take any action to advocate for something if we really don't care one way or another? If I'm neutral about it, I'm not really going to feel motivated to do anything about it.
Actually, if you're completely equanimous, you will be the most, you have the potential to be the greatest hero in society, because you will not be afraid of anything. And because you are practicing the practice of truth, the practice of peace, and the practice of kindness, you can speak your truth, and you can do so with complete freedom, because it doesn't matter what anybody tries to do with you, because you've got that equanimity. So even if they, you know, like speaking about peace and people treat you like an idiot or, you know, something like that, it doesn't hurt you. Even if you get elected to be the chairwoman of the committee, your pride doesn't like swell up and start to create like your ego battles, making you less effective as a leader. So this really wide and deep equanimity gives you a bigger, like a freedom of action. It gives you the ability to be sympathetic towards your counterparts on the other side. And that will make you a much more effective communicator in being able to speak to them. There's this morning we ran a sutta where a group of partisans on the other side wanted to ruin the Buddha. So they got a beautiful young nun to hang around and pretend like she was the courtesan who was giving sexual favors to the Buddha. And then they murdered that beautiful lady and put it out that the Buddha had been This is the Me Too movement, that they put it out that the Buddha had been sexually exploiting this young nun and subsequently got her murdered. So the Buddha said it's because these people have picked up their views and opinions based on wanting to have some advantage, that they've gotten locked into their opinions in a way that it's very difficult for them to escape from being trapped inside their own opinions. Now, these people had arranged for a murder, and they attempted to destroy the Buddha. And his response to them is like in this very sympathetic way, seeing how trapped they are by the sort of the path they're going down and the psychology that they have. And so the same way, when you're equanimous, you can understand the people on the other side much more easily, and you can speak to them effectively with compassion and sympathy because of having this foundation of equanimity.
Thank you. That was a beautiful explanation. I appreciate it.
If we only had a few people who were more enlightened, it could have such an effect on our whole country and on the whole world. I don't think we need to have, 50% or 60% or 80% of the people to be enlightened in order for the world to be a better place. So just a few people who are practicing very sincerely and diligently and who are attaining these levels of equanimity can be really transformative for a much bigger community, and can create, like, it's like creating an opening, I guess. What it'd be like if we're in a dark room and somebody knows where the exit is, and they find the exit and open the door, and all the people in the dark room can see the light, and they can see, oh, there's the way out. See, so it can be powerful.